Hello and welcome to the Cycle Systems Academy podcast. I'm really thrilled to invite this week one of our instructors, Chris Jones. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Sean. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So a good few people listening will have met you at the Academy and have been taught by you. And we're going to get into your story shortly. But you've been working with us for a while now. So tell us a bit about working for Cycle Systems.
Well, I've got to be honest, Sean. I mean, I absolutely love the job. And I'm not just saying that because you're my boss. it genuinely, for somebody who is so passionate about bikes, but it also as a trained teacher, to now be in a position where, my working day is just literally teaching people about bikes. It's like a dream job. It really is. I love it. And all of the people that come through the academy are really enthusiastic. We have a wide range of sort of start points for people, ranging from people who are working in bike shops to people who haven't been on a bike themselves for many, many years. Trying to bring all those individuals along collectively as a group is a hugely rewarding challenge. And I just love it. I love my job. I love every day I'm in.
Well, that's certainly good to hear. And I certainly think that it is generally reflected in cyclists and bike mechanics and people who work in the bike industry. You know, my little oft-repeated joke is not many plumbers are passionate about toilets, whereas, you know, people who work with bikes love bikes. I popped into Vintage Velo Services in Bern today, run by Eric, whom I hope to get on the podcast soon, and it's all these incredible retro bikes. And of course, Eric has got a story about every single bike, every single jersey. And he's a happy man, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not sure, not every minute of every day, but you know what I mean? Compared to someone who fits a toilet and then the customer says, no, can you move it 2 millimeters this way?
Yeah.
As happens. So that's where you're at now, and we can talk about more of that later. But your story, ever since I first met you, I thought was incredibly inspiring. And I'm sure many of our listeners will. It's why I wanted you to come on. So let's go back to, you know, Chris is 16, leaving school. What was your first job and what happened from there?
Well, actually, funnily enough, my first job ever was a paper round that I used to do. And I probably started that when I was about 13 or 14. But when I left education, the first thing I did was, I suppose really you'd call it like a handyman sort of job. And I did everything from cleaning people's gutters to stripping anti-fouling off the fishing boats. And it was just sort of filling in time really, because the thing that I really wanted to do was to join the armed forces. And I was just sort of, keeping myself occupied until I was able to actually get away and get into my basic training.
And you live in Ivy Bridge near Plymouth at the moment. So are you from that area?
I'm born and brought up in Tynmouth, which is up on the coast about 30 miles away from here. So I've always been I've always been in Devon, aside from my time away in the military. And Dartmoor particularly has always been a feature. Even though I was born and brought up on the coast, Dartmoor was a thing for me. I mean, I can still remember taking my prized 10-speed bike, sort of rolling down the hill and over the river to Sheldon, and then riding the Templar Way when the tide was out. So all the way up along the bank of the River Teme, through Newton Abbott, up through Stover, well, what is now Stover Country Park, and then out and up the Bovey to Hator climb, get up to the top of Hator, and then just literally turn around and fly back down the hill again and make my way home. So yeah, I've always been around this area, and Dartmoor in particular has always been a big part of my life.
Awesome. And funnily enough, that ride you just described, that's one that could easily be done by someone staying at Cycle Systems on a course. You could do that in a morning, couldn't you, before the class started?
Yeah, well, we have people quite frequently, and it always puts a smile on my face, because, you know, one of the things that students often ask is, oh, you know, where's good to ride? Where can we go? And, you know, Hay Tour is one that we always sort of recommend and highlight for people. And what I particularly loved through the summer was that it would tend to be that they would finish at the academy, and then jump on their bikes and get up to Hay Tour for sunset and then back down. And it was always quite interesting to see who the following morning was sprightly and ready to go and who was dead on their feet.
Yeah, we were lucky enough one year that Tour of Britain had a Hay Tour summit finish on a school day. So we literally finished a bit early and we rode up together and watched. I think Wout Powell's won for Team Sky that day.
Lovely. Yeah, great stuff. It's just, I mean, it's a great climb anyway, but, you know, to be able to combine it with going and watching something like that would be pretty special.
Yeah, definitely. So let's get back to your story then. So what happened when you joined the military?
Yeah, well, so I joined the military in 93, signed up into the Army Air Corps, because my real want was military flying, military aviation. And I thoroughly loved it. It was everything I wanted and more. Unfortunately, my cycling took a quite a major back seat for a while, although I did pick up my mountain biking a little later on during my time. But for the first couple of years, I was so busy. The cycling unfortunately sort of dropped away, but it was a part of my life that I was just supremely happy with. You know, it being in and around military aviation all day every day was hugely fulfilling, really challenging, but so enjoyable. Absolutely loved it. Unfortunately, partway into my career, I was doing very nicely. I'd qualified as a landing point commander. I was a class one trooper in all three trades, and was looking forward to a good career. And unfortunately, I suffered an injury whilst, of all things, we were playing baddies for a group of officer cadets coming through Sandhurst. And to cut a long story short, I had a thunder flash thrown at me. And unfortunately, you're taught that thunder flashes, although there's not a lot to them, they're not things to be messed around with, and you certainly don't throw them at people. But unfortunately, this particular one was thrown at me, and the concussive blast from it knocked me off my feet. And unfortunately, right behind me was the trench I'd just climbed out of, and I dropped into the trench, which was about 4 feet deep, and shattered the arch of my left foot, tore the Achilles tendon, broke my right ankle, tore the medial ligament in my right knee, and funnily enough, I was literally hauled back up onto my feet to finish out the day. And I remember getting back to the barracks that afternoon, and my legs were in so much pain. And the boots we used to wear then were quite sturdy high top boots, and you know, you lace them really nicely tight so they're properly fitted. And I had a nice pair of boots, really well broken in. My absolute, I mean, ask any soldier, boots are right up there with your rifle. But I unlaced my boots and took my boots off, and it was like I could watch my ankle just inflate. And I wound up getting taken to Princess Alexandra Hospital in Aldershot, and unfortunately, the damage to my foot and my ankle, which were hugely obvious, meant that the tendon injuries were completely overlooked. And I mean, for a medial ligament injury, that's not a hugely problematic thing, given that I was putting casts and was off work anyway. But my Achilles injury wasn't actually diagnosed until 7 years later. And unfortunately, by that point, I'd developed so many problems in my left knee that I'd been sent for an operation. But the operation was based on a misdiagnosis because the Achilles tendon injury was unknown. And I wound up having a completely unnecessary surgery, which then left me in a worse position than when I'd started. And at that point, the army turned around to me and said, thank you, but you are no longer needed. And that was me sent on my way.
Wow. So it's a real catalogue of staggering misfortune. And, you know, you can only imagine that for a lot of people that would lead to a downward spiral. But actually, you know, you've done a tremendous amount since then. So what happened after you left the army?
Well, there most certainly was a downward spiral. I left the army. I was 25 years old. My partner at the time was 5 months pregnant. I was put on a combination of steroids and dihydrocodeine. Dihydrocodeine is actually used as an alternative to methadone for treating heroin addicts. And so with the dihydrocodeine, I was sleeping for 16 or more hours a day. And with the steroids, my weight just ballooned. I went from 11 stone to 14, which is a substantial increase for somebody my size at 5'6". And it was a pretty difficult time. I went to the Royal British Legion to ask for help, and they sent somebody out to assess me. And the outcome of that was that I was told that if I decided to go to college or university, the British Legion would buy my textbooks for me. Now, given that I couldn't walk, that wasn't a huge amount of help at the time. So I went to SAFA, and SAFA turned around to me and said, gosh, yeah, no, that's quite a story. But you're not really the kind of person we support, and you'd be much better off going to the British Legion. And at that point, I just thought, well, do you know what? That's me on my own. I'm the only person that's going to get this sorted out. So I came off the steroids, and I came off the dihydrocodeine. I was still on medication. I just went to my GP and said that I was not prepared to live the rest of my life on such extreme medication. And I started getting myself back together. And the key thing, love them or loathe them, the key thing that really helped me to sort of get myself back into any kind of physical activity was an exercise bike. And I just had to literally dial all of the tension, the friction off the wheel. So I literally just spinning like a hamster in a cage. But just that physical activity and getting my legs moving, really, really helped. Unfortunately, my son, by this point, had been born, and not that that was the unfortunate part. The unfortunate part was that his mother eventually decided that she couldn't cope with me in the state I was in. And so she decided to leave and took my son with her. And that's another proper kick in the teeth when you're already pretty damn low. I was in some quite dark places. I'd sort of the cycling or the exercise bike, unfortunately for me, had proved one thing, which was I'd been told by the doctors that I'd never ride again. And the exercise bike, as good as it was at getting me physically active, it was proof that they were right. I could not put any friction on that wheel at all, because my knees in particular just simply could not deal with that force going through them, trying to turn a wheel that had any resistance on it. So I actually got into kayaking, and in particular, kayak surfing, which was a fantastic way for me to exercise, and combined two things that I'd done previously to give me a very, very physical outlet, but one that I could do sitting down. And I enjoyed kayak surfing for many, many years. I wound up going to university, and I was studying for 4 years at Plymouth University, and continued my surfing during my time there. And when I graduated, I went into teacher training and became a physics teacher, which I thoroughly loved. I particularly enjoyed teaching the very, very high ability kids that I had in my A-level groups, but also teaching the very, very low ability kids who had some quite complex special educational needs. Those two groups who were sort of polar opposites, they were my highlights for my time in teaching. Unfortunately for me, as I thought I was on a somewhat upward trajectory, I started to suffer really badly with an awful lot of pain, and my medication just was not doing what it should have done in terms of relieving some of the pain that I was in. And I eventually wound up going and being seen by a specialist consultant at Derriford, and I was diagnosed with a neurological disorder. And unfortunately, this neurological disorder came with two caveats. The first one was that I could no longer work full time. And when I turned around to the doctor and said, "Well, okay, so what are we talking about, like 80% here?" No, Chris, 50% is your new maximum. That's your working week. And the other one was that I had to give up surfing because I risked blacking out or fitting. And obviously, being on the water, that was quite a risky place to be for somebody who could black out and lose consciousness. So I started looking for sort of alternatives in terms of activities that could replace my surfing. And eventually I came back to bikes. And I decided that I wanted to get back into mountain biking. But the only way I could do it was to adapt hand crank bikes or trikes to enable me to ride off road. And that got a bit that was certainly an interesting journey, actually. If you've never actually ridden a hand crank trike and you get the opportunity, I would strongly urge you to, just purely so that you can appreciate when you're watching events like the Paralympics, and you see, you know, men and women charging around, pedaling with their arms, just appreciate just how difficult that is.
Yeah, absolutely incredible athleticism. And I'm just saying, Chris, that you're being incredibly modest about your surfing achievements. It's worth saying that Chris was told he'd never surf again, as well as ride again. And you ended up as a bronze medalist in the World Adaptive Surfing Champs. So you certainly did some quite amazing stuff there in the surfing before you moved on. And so with the cycling then, again, sort of what happened from the hand crank bikes? What were you doing with it? Were you competing? Were you doing it just for pleasure?
Well, funnily enough, my first hand crank bike that I bought, from a lady called Karen Dark. And for anyone who has followed Paralympic hand cycling, you'll recognize the name. I certainly didn't at the time. And I bought this bike from Karen, and I had to go and collect it from her parents' house. So I never actually got to meet her. But we kept in touch, and she was always, because I told her what I was going to do with it, and she was keen to sort of find out how I got on, because although she was very racing and road oriented, she had a real desire to get back to outdoor sports, because rock climbing was her previous passion and was how she wound up injured. And I remember having a conversation with Karen on the phone in 2012, and I still hadn't clicked as to who she was. And we were chatting away on the phone, and she said to me at the end of the conversation, she said, "Chris," she said, if you try to get hold of me over the next few months and I don't answer," she said, "please don't think I'm ignoring you." She says, "it's just that I've got to get prepared now for the Paralympics." I was like, "What?" She said, "yes." And then I found out who she was. And of course, she then went on and medaled in those games as well, which was awesome to watch. That bike that I bought from Karen, we made some major modifications to it to enable me to do some really quite crazy things. I got very heavily into downhill mountain biking on that bike, and it was able to take me places, because there were some other four-wheeled, they're not actually bikes, they have no propulsion, they're purely gravity driven, almost like go-karts but with very heavy duty suspension and mountain bike components, but they need extremely wide tracks to be able to run. And my nearest downhill place is Gorton. And for anybody who knows Gorton, Gorton used to be used quite frequently in some of the mountain bike magazines. And they would bring pros down to time themselves down the 104 challenge, which, if I remember rightly, I think was on Super Tavi. But the trails there are very narrow. And so my trike, I think the track width on it was something like 73 centimeters. So, I mean, narrower than most handlebars are these days on mountain bikes. And so I could fit down all sorts of trails. And I was doing some insane stuff. I mean, you know, gap jumps and all sorts. And the bike itself It was a fully rigid steel frame. It was running 20-inch Halo wheels. It had a single Magura hydraulic rim brake on the front wheel. And it was, I think it was 16 speed, purely powered by hand. And it was a beast of a piece of kit. But yes, I mean, some of the stuff that I did on that was, I mean, I had no business, absolutely no right to do some of the things that I did.
Awesome.
But the, you know, I even wound up in a few races, right, you know, and I have to say a huge thank you to the Woodland Riders, and Chaz in particular, who, you know, made an awful lot of adjustments and alterations to things to enable me to be able to go and race with everybody else. Fantastic group of people. But then I have to say, one of the things I very quickly learned was that mountain biking in general, I mean, the people, the community, they were so much more welcoming than surfing had ever been. I mean, you know, people used to, I mean, they were just flat out rude when I would turn up to surf in a kayak. You know, I would turn up to ride on this Mad Max trike, and people were just like, "That's amazing! Just go for it." Yeah, we actually wound up. I wound up a little bit disillusioned with the bike, just purely because I was so limited in what I could do with it. So I started working with a chap, local guy, Kev Swan. And we built a full steel, full suspension hand crank trike. And it was, a beast of a piece of kit. And some more friends of mine then helped me to enter the what was then the Bontrager 2412. And it was the first time that British Cycling had ever allowed a hand cycle to compete on the same course at the same time as able-bodied riders. And I mean, what a course to pick to allow that to happen.
Mental.
Oh, it was crazy. And the weather was brutal. It was absolutely brutal. I went down there on the Saturday, and the guys turned around to me and said, "Look, Chris, if you don't mind, obviously, you know, you're not racing to win anything here. But there are people who clearly are. Would you mind riding on Sunday rather than Saturday? Because there's going to be, you know, by Sunday, things will be a lot more spread out and a lot more slowed down than they're going to be on Saturday." And it was a beautiful day. And I'm like, "Yeah, no problem. You know, whatever works for you guys." So I rock up on Sunday morning, and it was biblical. It was 2015, and it was biblical. But man, we had such a laugh getting that bike and me round the course.
Tell us, anyone who doesn't know, tell us about the event and about the course. So what was that like?
So the 2412 is what it says it is. It's a 24 or 12 hour endurance ride. And it's held at Newnham Park in Plymouth. And I mean, there are all sorts of races within races. So sometimes you'll have the British champs will be on. You'll have the fat bike champs will be on. There's all sorts of other races going on within the races themselves. So you get a really eclectic mix of amazing people down there. It's now the Exposure 2412. And a couple of years ago, when I went back, I went back to the guys and I said, "Look, guys, you know, I'm now riding electric bikes. Would you let me come and ride your race on my electric bike?" And they went away and had some time to sort of think about it and speak to a few people, within the racing community. And they came back and said, "Yeah, absolutely, yeah, we'd love to have you. So I'm the only person to have ridden the 2412 by hand, and I'm also the only person to have ridden the 2412 on an e-bike. So I'm super stoked with that for the moment. I'll have to think up something else now. But it's an amazing weekend, and you know, you've got a whole sort of tented village and people come down. You've got little cafe tents, and then you've got sort of people come down with demo stock and stuff, and it's a really nice vibe. Some lovely people. The other year when I was down there on the e-bike, the exposure guys just invited me over to their tent, and we just went and sat and just chatted shit, and you know, had some biscuits and some brews, and it's just lovely. If you've never been, it's a great event to go to, just because everybody there is so welcoming.
Well, we'll get the link in the show notes for sure, as well as some pictures of your hand cranked bikes. That sounds amazing.
If you want to break into the bike trade, train your staff, or even learn some new skills just for fun, Cycle Systems Academy has a course for you. Our graduates come to us from all over the globe and train with us to gain the highest recognised cycle mechanic qualifications available. The bike industry supports and believes in Cycle Systems Academy, which means they'll believe in you too.
So, I'm really interested to find out the involvement with Help the Heroes and when that kicked in and what they did to help you, because it sounds like SAFA and British Legion didn't do anything. And also the transition from the hand bikes to the e-bikes.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, I have to say, when I first approached Help for Heroes, they told me to bugger off as well. It was a weird time, because there were certain groups of people who were getting loads of support. So if you were a World War II veteran, you were covered. And if you were an Afghan or Iraq II veteran, you were completely covered. But if you fell anywhere in between, nobody was interested. And funnily enough, 2014, I reached a real low point, and actually I was planning to take my own life. I'd had enough. It just felt like I was constantly fighting everybody. It took me 12 years from my discharge before I actually got my war disablement pension. And the pensions service actually went on record as saying that they were utterly disgusted by the MOD and the SPVA and the way that they treated me in that case. But it was just another example of where I just had to fight and fight and fight. And I just reached a point where I thought, you know, I'm fucking done with this. I can't keep doing it. And it was literally right at the end. In fact, it was about this time, 2014. And I got through Christmas and New Year, and I went back into work. My first day back in work in 2015, a colleague of mine whose husband was a Royal Marine handed me a business card for a friend of his who had just left the service and gone to work for Help for Heroes. And she said that they'd been talking about me over the Christmas and New Year period and had been explaining to Larry about my hand mountain biking. And, you know, Larry said it was the kind of thing that the charity were right into. And so he'd given them the card to pass on to me. So I wound up with this card. And it took me until April to build up the courage to actually call, because I the more I thought about it, I sort of thought, do you know, the trouble is, these guys have already told me to sling my hook. If I go back to them now and they tell me that again, that could be the thing that is the final straw, and that's it. I'm done. But this time around, I phoned them up, and basically Help for Heroes turned around and went, yeah, absolutely, we can help you. And I had somebody come around to the house and did an assessment and looked at my service record and all that stuff. And basically helped for Heroes turn around and went, look, you know, yes, we will help you. We will support you with the maximum level of support that we can, and we will support you for life.
Amazing.
Yeah, well, it really was, Sean. I mean, that was then what really pushed me to go and enter the 24/12. I then went on from there, and the following year I competed at the Invictus Games. I then did the Big Battlefield Bike Ride, which was an amazing experience. 350 miles in 5 days by hand, following the old World War I front lines.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was a great ride. I did have one sketchy day in the middle, where my mind really went to town on me, but other than that, I really did had a fantastic time. And really, it's been because as soon as Help for Heroes said yes, we'll support you, it opens up all sorts of other doors, and it's like all the charities come together. I mean, I should be, to be fair, the British Legion did step in and start helping me when I was diagnosed with the neurological problems. But the level of support from Help for Heroes was in a completely different league. Really, you know, light years ahead of anything else. It was funny because that was actually then what got me back into surfing, because Help for Heroes started taking me up to surf Snowdonia, which is an indoor, an inland surfing lagoon, up in Snowdon, in Wales. And, it was brilliant because if I blacked out, I'm literally 20 feet from the nearest lifeguard. And yet I'm, you know, happily surfing on sort of 2-3 foot super clean, fun waves, nobody else there to give me any shit. And it was through that I wound up getting selected for the GB team and then went out to California for the World Adaptive Surfing Championships. And it was whilst I was out there then that Keith Bontrager invited me to pop up to his house, which was quite surreal. So I'd met Keith at the Bontrager 24/12 several years before. I think it was the 2012 one. In fact, that's a good story in itself. So a friend of mine, Jude, who was a British cycling commissar, he commissarred the 24/12 for a few years. And this one particular year, he said, Chris, come on down, you know, because he lived down in Cornwall. We didn't see each other too often. Chris, come on down to the 24/12 and, you know, we'll hook up and, you know, shoot some shit. And so I went down. And of course, being the commissar, he was a bit busy. But he sat me down at one of the cafe tents and he disappeared off. And then he came back and he said, Chris, this is Keith. Keith would love to hear what you're doing with your hand bikes. I've got a shoot off. I'll be back in a bit. So Keith sits down with me and I've got no idea who he is, not a clue. Keith sits down and we're chatting away. I don't know, 20, 30 minutes. And then Keith turns around to me and says, Chris, he said, it's been fascinating. I've really got to go. There's some stuff I've got to do. But, you know, we'll chat again, I'm sure. And off he goes. And then Jude comes back and said, how did you get on with Keith? I said, yeah. I said, he's a lovely bloke. I said, he was really interested in the bikes and everything. He goes, yeah, that was Keith Bontrager. You wanker. But anyway, long story short, Keith and I then kept in touch. And when I rode the 2015 one on my full suspension bike, Keith was just all over it. I mean, he loved it. And the funny thing was, Keith actually told me another time, he said that the thing was that he'd made so many bespoke hand crank bikes for US veterans and it had never once occurred to him to build them a hand crank mountain bike. And he said he was kicking himself. He couldn't believe it. But and it took seeing me and what I was doing for him to think, holy crap, you know, that's what I should have been. But it was amazing. And like I said, I'm out in California for the World Adaptive Surfing Championships, and Keith pings me a message and says, would you like to come up to the house? Unbelievable.
Amazing. And of course, a fellow physicist as well. Masters in physics, Keith Pontranger.
It was genuinely such an amazing bloke. I'm truly humbled that he, you know, was willing to consider me as a friend. Because he really, a guy who's got a hell of a story himself, actually. I mean, I don't know if you know what happened with his wife, Judy. They're obviously both cyclists. She was a midwife up in London, and I think Camden they lived in. And Keith and Judy were out for a ride one day, and Judy was in front of Keith, and they were overtaken by Tesco's lorry, which then turned left, took her off her bike, and she ultimately lost a leg. And Keith obviously then had quite a vested interest then in adaptive cycling and what things can be done to enable people with injuries to be able to stay on their bikes. So yeah, it, incredible story. If you can ever get Keith on the podcast, go for it.
We have had him on very early, actually. And now you tell the story, I remember it, because I do believe the first responder on the scene to that was a cycling paramedic from the London Ambulance Service, who, of course, are very old friends of ours. That was one of our first ever jobs, was servicing those bikes. So I do recall that now.
It was a super sad story. And actually, it was Keith took Judy, and they went back out, I believe, permanently or semi-permanently back out to California, because Keith knew that she could get the care that he wanted her to have out there, and he didn't think she was going to be able to get that care here from the NHS, which was a real shame.
So quite an amazing connection with one of the legends of mountain biking there. So tell us about your Invictus Games, because I mean, you're in a documentary, The Road to the Games, which again, I'll put the link on the show notes, guys, which is really incredible. But obviously it's a hell of a deal. So tell us about your journey to the Games and your experience there.
So the Invictus Games was something that I had been aware of in 2014 when the first one took place up in London. And it was something that I looked at quite jealously, because, I saw these wounded and injured ex-servicemen and women getting this recognition. And all I'd ever had for being a wounded ex-serviceman was shit from just about everybody. So I looked at it with quite an amount of jealousy. But then the following year, when Help for Heroes started supporting me, one of the first things I said to them was, I want to be in the Invictus Games. And they ran the trials. I forget when it was. I think it was January of 2016, or it might have been towards the end of 2015. But to cut a long story short, I went up there on that original bike that I bought from Karen Dark, which by this point had been massively modified and had braces welded onto it, and, you know, obviously to strengthen it for the kind of riding I was doing. And I went up there on this brute of a bike, and we were up at the University of Bath, and they've got a lovely little track up on the top of the hill there. I forget the name of it. But we all went up there for the cycling trials, and I was like a bat out of hell. And how I rode at the speed I did on a bike that weighed as much as that one did, I have no idea. But I think the thing that possibly tilted it in my favor was that there was a corner on this track that had a grass bank around the outside of it. And I just used it as a berm. And it was, I mean, for me, it was just a complete no-brainer because I could wang through that corner with speed to burn. And of course, everybody else was riding on the hard paved track. So I made myself stand out a little bit. But it was great. You know, I got selected and I worked hard. I worked really hard. But I unfortunately, it was literally a matter of weeks before the actual games. I got a phone call from a locum doctor at my GP's practice. And this locum doctor told me that my medications had been reviewed and they wanted to change one of them because it was quite expensive. And would I consider taking an alternative? And I said that, no, I wouldn't, because this particular alternative that he mentioned was what I'd been on originally. And it had caused me some real serious problems. And that was why I'd been put on the medication that I was currently taking. And this guy got really angry with me and actually put the phone down on me, which I thought was really weird. And then literally within 2 minutes, he phoned me back. Right, I found another alternative. Will you be willing to try it? I said, okay, fine. I said, as long as it's not that first one you mentioned. So I got my medication changed. And a couple of weeks later, I was up at the pharmacy to collect my prescription. And whilst I was there, I said to the pharmacist who I, funnily enough, I know my pharmacist really well. But I said to the pharmacist, I said, look, you know, I'm having a lot of trouble sleeping at the moment. I've got no problem dropping off, but I just don't seem to be able to stay asleep. And so she started looking at my notes and she went, oh my God. She said, are you still taking the nortriptyline? I said, no. I said, that's what they took me off. I said, that's why I'm on this one now. And she went, oh Jesus, God, no. She said, there's no way you should have been taken off that. And so she then got me back onto my original medication and got the other one binned off. But unfortunately, by this point, the games were right on top of me. And so my preparation in the lead up to the games was pretty frigging dire. It was substantially less than ideal. And I would dearly love to be able to meet that idiot locum. And explain to him exactly what he did, because unfortunately, I got out to Invictus and I stood no chance of actually being in any way competitive. I mean, it was a great experience. I thoroughly enjoyed it. There were some things about it that I found really difficult. So, for example, you had teams who come over from Afghanistan, Jordan, Iraq. And we were out in Orlando and we're staying at the Shades of Green Resort, which is it's a military resort within the Disney complex. And I mean, it's like a paradise. And I see these guys from these countries and I mean, like, you know, the wheelchairs and the prosthetics and you can just tell there is absolutely no care for these people at all. And I'm looking at them and I'm looking at the surroundings and I'm thinking, oh my God, how must these people feel? You know, I mean, are they over the moon that they're here and they're just going to enjoy it while they can? Or are they looking at this and going, how is it that these people have got so much and we've got nothing? And it really played on me, actually. I found it really difficult. And it's one of the reasons why I would most certainly, I mean, that combined with the classification experience that I had to go through for the World Adaptive Surfing Championships, they're the two key reasons why I don't think I would ever bother trying to compete internationally ever again.
Yep. So it's a real massive contrast then between the haves and the have-nots in this world as in everywhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, you know, but it's like here you are, you can have this for 2 weeks and then you have to go home again.
Mm.
I mean, just why not spend the money that we spent on those games on those people instead who need it?
Yeah, exactly. And obviously there's a whole other podcast or series of podcasts where we could get much, much deeper into that.
Yes.
In terms of events, I actually posted on my personal Facebook the other day, the Mountain of Hell race. And I posted a picture of that and a video saying I would have loved to have been a mechanic at the bottom of this race. And for anyone that doesn't know the Mountain of Hell race, it's, you know, you all start on top of a glacier together and ride down with sort of hundreds of mountain bikers all smashing into each other and ice and rocks, and looks terrifying. And you were the first person to ever to compete that in the e-bike. So let's get the transition to the e-bike and then get into the Mountain of Hell.
Yes. Yeah, of course. I mean, so basically, I ended 2016. The weird thing was that I'd literally just won this bronze medal at the World Championships. And I forget, I came home on the 16th or 17th of December, went straight into Christmas and New Year, and then got into 2017. And I was like, right, I've got no events, I've got no goals, I've got no, you know, I was drifting. I was completely without direction. Because at this point, I wasn't working. I was full-time training and competing in my various different disciplines. And I went into 2017 with no events lined up, nothing. And I really started to spiral down again, really quite quickly, actually, scarily quickly, in fact. And I wound up getting support from a charity called Walking with the Wounded, who paid for me to go and be seen and treated by a clinical psychologist privately. And I remember going and seeing this guy and you know, literally week in, week out, just telling him all the reasons why I hated society. I was sick to the back teeth of it. And during that time, a friend of mine actually mentioned e-mountain bikes. Now, funnily enough, it was back in 2010 when I was working with one of the best NHS practitioners I've ever come across, a wonderful occupational therapist called Tracy James. And she spent months trying to persuade me to try an electric bike. And I was dead set against it. I was absolutely dead set against it. But when I eventually relented and went and tried one, I loved it. I bought it. But the trouble was, back in 2010, this bike came in, I think it was like a 19 or a 20 inch frame. And that was it. It was one size. Now I'm 5'6". So that was it was a bit of a stretch for me. The battery was dire. If I was really, really lucky and I just rode in one direction with the wind behind me, I might squeak out 25 miles out of a charge. And within 6 months, I got so frustrated that actually that was what then drove me to the hand bikes. But from that point on, I put zero thought into electric bikes at all. And so this friend, I think it was around April, May time in 2017, mentioned electric mountain bikes. And so off I went and I started looking. And I'm like, oh my God, these things got good. And so I went and tried a few, and I wound up buying one, which I collected literally the last couple of days of July that year. My first appointment with my psychologist in September, he turned around to me and he said, "Chris, do you know what?" He said, "There's no point in you coming in here anymore." He said, "You found your treatment." And it was mountain biking. I, for the first time since before I'd been discharged, I was able to go straight out the front of my house and out into the middle of Dartmoor on my own without any help or support. And to be able to gain that kind of access, albeit that it is extremely limited for cyclists, but to be able to gain that kind of access back was literally life-changing.
And that's the joy of the e-bike, isn't it? They are just incredible freedom machines.
Well, it's, so if you think, remember back to what I was saying about the exercise bikes, you know, I had to ride them with all the resistance taken off. Well, that's what I can do with e-bikes. I can literally, even during the course of a ride, I can change the programming on the bike to increase the levels of support or decrease the levels of support. And so it doesn't matter whether I'm having a good day or a bad day, I can still go out on my bike. And the best thing is, if I black out or have a fit while I'm out on my bike, I'm just going to fall on the floor. I'm not going to drown or anything, you know. So in terms of the risks for me, actually, the biggest risk for me is me. I probably have done stuff on my mountain bikes in the last, 4 years, that once again, I probably have no business doing. And actually, Mountain of Hell was probably an extremely good example of that.
What was that like to ride? Because it just looks like absolute bedlam.
Oh, dude, honestly. So you're sat at the top. I mean, so the way Mountain of Hell works is you have your qualifying runs, which are on a short track. And basically, your position where you qualify dictates where you start in the race. Now, we were doing it as a Help for Heroes group. All of us were injured in one way or another. And so the organizers had said, regardless of where you place in qualifying, you will start at the back. So on the day, you start very early in the morning because they've got to ferry hundreds of people to the top of the glacier. And, you know, 11,500 feet. And it was a pristine day, absolutely pristine. And you've got the sound systems up there, and it's just blaring out Highway to Hell the whole time. And it was absolutely stunning. You know, then the horn goes and like everybody's on their bikes and going. And you can't actually see down onto the slope from the start. So it's only as you roll over the top that you then see the mountain open up out in, you know, below you. And I was just like, I'm just fucking going. And so I just let go of the brakes. Now bear in mind, I wish that I could have been at the front and had the pristinely groomed snow that the leaders had to ride on. Because I forget who was clocked fastest that day, but the top speed that was clocked on the speed gun was 124k an hour. I managed just over 92, and that was in the slushy snow that had been ridden over by several hundred other bikes. And I just think, no, if I'd had that groomed snow, I could have definitely gone over 100. No shadow of a doubt. But I was lucky. I was the year. So the following year, 2019, was the year when they filmed that massive crash at the first bottleneck which looked brutal.
It did.
But we thankfully we didn't have anything anywhere near as bad. There were some comings together, obviously, and I had one myself, largely because as I realized the speed I was going and saw the bottleneck coming towards me, I thought I'd better slow myself down. So I hauled on the anchors and literally just balled my brake. Couldn't use the front brake, so I was back brake only. And literally just boiled it in an instant. And, that was it. I did try to navigate my way through as best I could. I wound up clipping somebody and went down. But it was literally just a case of heaping as much snow as I could onto that caliper. And then off I went again and down the next slope. And but the actual riding, I mean, it's if you're a keen and competent mountain biker, the actual riding is insanely good. It is so good. It would have been nice to be able to just ride it at my own speed rather than being sort of restricted and held back by riding as part of a team. Because the way we rode it was that we all rode the sections on our own, but then we would stop and regroup. And that meant we were constantly waiting for the slower members of the group. And that was frustrating because it would have been nice to see where I would have placed in the field overall had I been able to just go at my own pace. But I have to say the biggest issue I had was the further down the hill I got, the more knackered my legs were getting. And they eventually gave out on me as we came through the bike park section. I wound up flying off the track. And it came a right cropper, but again was able to get up and finish out the race. But the funniest thing was that we then got on the gondola and came back up into the village. And the first thing I did was went and got my Auramorph and took a big dose because my legs were in bits. So I took a big dose of Auramorph, got in the shower, got myself clean. And we went off to the prize giving ceremony, and I hadn't realised, but they were doing a special prize for us for being the first group of disabled people to take part. And I was just sort of, that was it. My Auramorph was kicking in, and they've actually got a photo of everybody else up on the stage. And I'm just propped up at the front of the stage. I've got my crutches. I'm just literally propped up at the front of the stage. And I look absolutely off my head. And it's because I actually genuinely was.
Well, just like racing cyclists through the years. That's very traditional.
Oh, I was going to say, Lance Armstrong. But, I actually didn't wake up until 4 hours later. In the minibus on the way, back out the mountains. It was mad.
So essentially, Chris, you've taken your experiences in life and with mountain biking to really give back to the local community. And when I first met you, it was when you were involved with the MTB Collective in Plymouth. So tell us all about that.
Yeah. So, I'm a qualified. I'm now a qualified tutor, and I teach people to become trail leaders and coaches. But once I actually got back on a bike and I got my confidence being back on two wheels, the school I was working at the time, which was a very inner city school in Plymouth, with a lot of kids from some very deprived areas. I decided to start a club at the school, a mountain bike club, so that we could get some of those kids, because we literally, genuinely, we had kids who had never even left the city limits, never mind being out to the woods, which literally 5 miles from the city centre. And some of these kids didn't even know Dartmoor existed. And so I thought, we'll start this group and we'll get some kids out. and it just exploded. We had, it was something like 50 members, girls and boys aged 8 up through to 16. We had kids with physical disabilities, learning disabilities, mental health problems, gender identity issues. I mean, you name it, we had it. We had a family of Iraqi asylum seekers. We had all sorts of people. The biggest frustration in all of that, though, was that because it was a school club and we were using school kits, we could only take kids from the school. So if the kid left the school, they couldn't ride with us anymore. Kids from whose parents were teachers at the school but went to a different school, they couldn't ride with us. So we wound up dissolving the school club, and we started up as a community interest company. And we hit the ground running in February of last year. And then, of course, in March of last year, the whole world shut down. So the timing of that wasn't brilliant. But weirdly, and I'm really genuinely not entirely sure how, but weirdly, we managed to grow in terms of our numbers of volunteers, numbers of riders, and financially as the pandemic went on, which was really bizarre. But we kept people engaged by running online activities and competitions. So, who can wheelie the furthest, who can manual the furthest, who can do a stoppies, all these kinds of, bunny hops and different challenges that we put on through our Facebook group to keep kids engaged and keep them keen. And it's been a strange time, but I'm really hoping that we're going to be able to go into 22 and get in a full year of riding. It would be nice to be able to get back to that for sure.
Well, here's to that, Chris. And also, for anyone listening who's got a course booked at Cycle Systems and is looking forward to coming down and learning, I'm sure you'll agree that as one of your tutors, Chris is going to have an incredible wealth of experience to teach you. All of these adapted bikes and your experience competing at the highest level. So, Chris, it's been absolutely fantastic to have you on the podcast and hear your stories. And it feels like we could talk for several hours more. For people listening who do want to find out more, where can they find about you and the MTB Collective online?
So the MTB Collective, we're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, and our website is themtbcollective.org.uk. The website, I would ask you to have just a little bit of patience. We've literally just been given a grant to develop the website. So you might want to give that a month or two before you pop in to visit that, because at the moment it's not particularly exciting. But the Facebook group and the Instagram feed, we're putting stuff up there every week from the kids, and we're getting some really, really lovely results with some of our kids at the moment. And you'd be very welcome to come and share that.
That's absolutely fantastic. Well, Chris, thanks so much for joining us. Everyone listening, thanks so much for listening. And I really hope you enjoyed the stories. This is going to be the last podcast of the year, so I hope you all have an awesome Christmas. Don't call it a holiday, guys. I'm not a Christian, but I still call it Christmas. Come on, fat guy in a red suit. It's what it's all about. Have a great Christmas. Have a great new year. And here's to 2022.
Yeah, and to you, Sean. Thanks very much. And for everybody out there, have a great holiday, whatever you want to call it. And hope to see you in 2022.